Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am swell.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Real quick note, first up here at the top, big news about the show. We are spinning off from The Bulwark. Long story short, you'll be able to find this podcast at movieisle.substack.com. We'll have a proper URL set up eventually here. But you will still be able to listen to the Tuesday episodes as usual. We'll have a whole subscription drive thing, etc. But we'll be over there from now on. The folks at the Bulwark have been great. I am still going to remain at the Bulwark, but this podcast will be its own separate entity from now on. Hopefully we'll be able to do some video. I gotta figure out how to do video. We'll keep doing audio. It'll be fun. It'll be good times. We may work in some drinking into this show. I don't know. Peter's got a cocktail Substack. We've got all sorts of other plans, but anyway, it theoretically not much will change for you if you're listening to this. We'll walk you through it if you have any questions, but it's at movieisle.substack.com. should be fun. All right, and now on to controversies and non-controversies. Breaking news: movies are super expensive to make in Los Angeles, California. This is of course not true of every movie. You can shoot a movie on your iPhone in your backyard right now. But it is mostly true for, you know, the sorts of movies and TV shows that people actually watch in movie theaters and on streaming services and on network TV. Shooting in California means you have to pay big crews, big money for long stretches of time. You got to pay union mandated minimums. You have to pay enormous location fees. All of this adds up. And Los Angeles, the longtime home of the entertainment industry, is feeling the pinch. Ben Fritz hits the lowlights in the Wall Street Journal last week, profiling a handful of individuals who have seen their jobs dry up. He gets some good human interest stuff in there before hitting the brutal stats. In 2022, there were 142,000 people working in the entertainment industry. By 2024, that number was down to 100,000 and will likely be even lower by the end of this year. That's because the decline of movies and TV shows with budgets of at least $40 million continues. That stat was down 30% from 2022 to 2024, and it's off another 13% this year. The reasons for this decline are numerous. Part of it has to do with the combination writer and actor strikes that happened a couple years back. Part of it has to do with a shift in the business more broadly, right? At the height of the peak TV / peak streaming boom, when companies were pushing for more and more content in the hopes of attracting more and more subscribers, tons of stuff was getting made. Just tons and tons of hour-long television shows, half-hour-long television shows, original films, et cetera, et cetera. Just so much stuff was getting made. The companies have shifted from focusing on audience acquisition to profitability, which means spending less on content in the hopes of retaining audiences at lower rates. Less content means fewer jobs, particularly when a lot of those jobs, like animation and special effects, are getting wiped out by generative AI. And part of it has to do with simple fact that making stuff in Los Angeles is just crazy expensive. You know, again, there are a lot of union-related costs when you're working with IATSE and the other trade unions. It's crazy expensive because of inflated location costs, getting permits, that sort of thing. Very expensive in Los Angeles. And it's crazy expensive by comparison because productions receive worse tax incentives to shoot in Los Angeles than they do in British Columbia or Georgia or London, England, or all over Eastern Europe, et cetera, et cetera. We could discuss incentives, and Donald Trump has this real bug in his brain about tariffs and how they can be used on this, truthing again last week that he will levy 100% tariffs, 100% tariffs on foreign films, which, as the Journal's Ben Fritz deadpans, quote, "It isn't clear how much a tariff would work, given that movies aren't physical products imported into the United States," end quote. And it's not clear to me that those jobs are coming back to Los Angeles particularly, even if a federal incentive gets passed, like those that are being argued for in Congress right now. A federal film incentive will make the United States, broadly speaking, a more attractive place to film, if such a thing were ever to come into existence. I really, good luck selling that to the MAGA lawmakers. You know, hey, we're going to give a bunch of money to those godless heathens out in California. That sounds good, right? I'm skeptical, but even then, the subsidies that exist in Georgia and Michigan and Louisiana and elsewhere still put California kind of on the short end of the stick. Peter, is Los Angeles just doomed to fade away as a hub of film production in general?
Well, I think the old model of Hollywood being the center of big budget film production is definitely going to go the way of the dinosaur. I just don't think it can last for all that long. That doesn't mean that Los Angeles is doomed. It doesn't mean that Hollywood is doomed. It doesn't mean that entertainment is doomed. But Los Angeles was built to, the Hollywood of Los Angeles was built for an era in which there was a huge amount of benefit from putting all the different types of skills and equipment and infrastructure, the financing, the people that you needed to make these incredibly complicated productions all in the same place, right? Think about what it takes to make a movie. You've got to have some money, people, right? Like, there's just this incredible kind of financial infrastructure that is involved in this. You've also got to have some people who are really technically sophisticated when it comes to lights and sound recording. And until 25 or 30 years ago, the development of film, which is actually quite complicated, right? Especially when you're doing this for 35 millimeter, you need to make all these prints, right? Like, there's just all of this stuff. And you've got to have people who are props experts, moving props around the world, moving props from one place to another is incredibly complicated and expensive, especially when these are one of a kind, quite complicated, quite pricey props to produce. I mean, there's a story actually from the first Dune film about just like how crazy the incredible steps they took to put one of those ornithopters, like to get it from where they built it, I believe in California. I could be mistaken about that, but they had to get it from somewhere to like Jordan or wherever it was they shot the movie. And it was just like this absolutely insane feat of logistical engineering. And those big budget movies, those big budget productions always require that. But these days, a lot of things don't require that because a lot of stuff is digital and because a lot of communications just have changed. And so Hollywood, like, forget all of the kind of policy factors, forget all of the kind of, forget Donald Trump, forget the unions, forget all of this. Like, the production mechanisms for making anything have changed so much that the thing that Hollywood was good at, which was having all of that stuff in one place, and then it was really difficult to do it anywhere else just because literally the physical logistics of it were so complicated. That's over. That's going to be done. And then there's all these other changes. There's the policy stuff, but there's mostly beyond the policy stuff, there's competition now in a way that there just wasn't. And that competition is mostly, you can sort of summarize it as YouTube. And YouTube is just such a huge, such a huge player in competing against what Hollywood does. There's also video games. There's also social media. There's all these sort of other things that are competing for people's screen time. And they're much cheaper. They don't need to be done in Hollywood. They don't require any kind of union labor. And so if you are working on that old model of we're going to do things the best way, the most expensive way, in the one place where we've gathered everybody to do the things, that model it's not gone this year, but it won't be around 20 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, Alyssa, this is, again, we can discuss the subsidies and all that, but it really does just seem that once upon a time, filmmaking was an extremely technical occupation. Set aside concentrating the talent of the writers and the directors and everything. It was just a thing that required a lot of equipment. You needed studios, you needed sound stages, you needed cameras that were very expensive. You needed people who were skilled at fixing and operating them. And now at this point, again, I'm not saying everybody can or should do this, but you can shoot a film on your camera. You can on the camera on your phone, right? Like you can pull your iPhone out and go out and shoot a proper film. And that does kind of obliterate the big advantage that that Los Angeles and California as an entity had for a long time.
Yeah. But I want to go back to something that you skipped over a little bit there. You said sort of setting aside the question of sort of concentrating that talent and putting it in one place. And I'm curious for both of you as to whether you think that there was sort of real discernible value in having that concentration of talent in one place.
So, yes, I think that the concentration of talent was hugely valuable. But I think the thing that was up until, let's say, 2005 or so, the kind of when the digital era in Hollywood began, when you started to see big movies shot on digital, and also just sort of when the internet kind of took over all everything, not just movies, but everything. Up until then, the concentration of talent was valuable, but even more than that, the concentration of talent plus physical infrastructure. Because it's expensive to build a soundstage in Louisiana or Michigan, two places that had big film credits for a long time, and where they did build, you know, shoot a lot of movies, because it's expensive to ship a lot of physical stuff from one place or another to another, because moving prop, you know, like having that all of those props warehouses, right? Like, and it's just, so part of it is the talent, and yes, it, like, that's valuable, just in the way that it's valuable in Washington to have all the policy people around to kind of talk to each other. You can go to dinners with them and go to panels and sort of get a sense of what everybody else is thinking. That's valuable, but it was also an infrastructure concentration as much as it was a talent concentration.
Yeah.
Melissa, are you asking if the studio system was good?
I guess what I'm asking is whether or not the diffusion of talent away from Los Angeles is going to change the nature and maybe the hegemony of American movies. I'm asking if there was something sort of distinct about the concentration of talent in Los Angeles and New York that helped make American pop culture sort of so world conquering, and whether that is going to continue in a more diffuse environment. And also, as sort of as a secondary question, whether, you know, the sort of diffusion of talent and as a result, the sort of weakening of relationships is going to change the nature of the movies that get made, right? I mean, the sort of concentration of movie making talent in Los Angeles becomes more diffuse. Are people less likely to take a chance on an idea by someone they know is talented, but, you know, maybe the idea is kind of crazy? Does it become more challenging for young people to find ways to break in because there isn't sort of a concentration of early jobs that gets you exposure to certain parts of the process that then would help you make your way up the ladder? I'm curious, like, yes, everything can be done more cheaply. Things can be done on a sort of greater variety of locations. You have broken up some of that concentration of infrastructure. But do you break up the setting that helped make American pop culture what it was?
So I actually think I would almost flip the thesis that I think is embedded in your question. And apologies if I'm misstating or misunderstanding this. But to me, this is going to be very bad for middle class, below the line talent who are employed. Those are the people who are going to lose out the most. Essentially, the kind of the creative
Wall Street Journal article is
the creative. They're not lower class by any means. The story opens with the story of somebody who has been an animator for a couple of decades. Reports that he was making about $100,000 a year. Not, you know, amazing wealth, but certainly like enough to live on by, you know, any stretch, even in Los Angeles. Like, it sounded like he owned a home in the Burbank area. But it is those people, and I was who are going to struggle the most, the people who had just wanted to, like, have a job, but have it be a creative job. And as I was reading this, I was obviously incredibly sympathetic to that person and their story. And I was also thinking about, I understand this person's like in his 40s or his 50s, he's mid-career, maybe even late mid-career. But this is, in its own way, one of the best times to kind of be scrappy and entrepreneurial in media. And I was thinking about a New York Times story from earlier this year in May, that's the headline is, "What if making cartoons becomes 90% cheaper?" And it's about a studio that has basically built out a kind of AI-assisted animation program. They still have animators, but instead of using some of the old computer programs that are pretty clunky to render things and also to kind of fill in the blanks between drawings, they're using AI, and it's just much faster and much more like, and therefore much less expensive. And I was just thinking about this guy who loves to draw, who's only drawing in his scrapbook. And this is like the opportunity for someone like that who wants to sort of strike out on his or her own, who wants to make their own thing, which is not going to be for everyone, which is, I understand, is not what everyone wants to do. Those people have fewer they are being gatekept less than ever before. They have fewer roadblocks, both technically and financially. You can launch a cartoon on YouTube just by yourself, and maybe it won't do well, for sure.
But yeah, like, 99% of them won't do well. I'm sorry, this is I love the Horatio Alger idea here of we're gonna free these people to start their own, and we're gonna have let 100 Walt Disney's bloom. Most of those people are going to end up out of the industry. Most of the people like this guy are going to lose their job, and they're not going to get another one because of generative AI's theft of intellectual property over the last 100 years, making them obsolete. That's the long and the short of it here. Again, like you can gussy this up however you want. You can tell them to learn to code or whatever, but it's those people are losing their jobs. Those people are losing their jobs, and they're not coming back. And like,
so
that's the reality of the situation. That's the reality of the situation.
Like I said, I'm very sympathetic here, and it's going to be pretty rough, I think, for a lot of middle-class people who had pretty decent jobs in the film industry. We talked earlier this year about Atlanta and what is happening there as Marvel is pulling out. And the Wall Street Journal did a story on this that led with somebody who had been a script coordinator making about $200,000 a year, working very hard, clearly, like long hours on a lot of shows, but like doing really quite well for a below the line talent here. Those are the people who are going to lose out here. And like, my heart goes out to them. They are in for a rough ride. And what I would just tell them, the advice I have, it's not even great. I understand. It's not even the best advice. It won't work for everyone. It won't work in every circumstance, but this is a crappy time for 100% of them. The only thing you can do is try to make something that is your own.
To a rounding error, it will not work for 100% of them. I'm glad that people will be able to use computer programs to animate the things that they can draw and put them on YouTube where they will be seen by 27 people.
This is not
a realistic answer to any of these people.
This podcast, I was watching Connor O'Malley's YouTube comedy special. He got his start just uploading random videos of himself, often while acting as a dog walker. That was his like main job, uploading random videos of himself to YouTube and other social media platforms, filmed a whole comedy special, tried to sell it to streamers and networks, people, to buyers. No one wanted it. Uploaded it to YouTube, and it is a gigantic hit. And he started by making videos of himself yelling into his phone, and that wasn't AI. That was a distribution technology chain.
I'm sure there's 10 million Connor O'Malley's out there, right? There's one who's actually been a success,
right?
There's more than Connor O'Malley, but. Yes, it's true. Not everyone will be a success, but that's always been true in Hollywood.
I think we've gotten very far away from my original question, which is like, I don't think we know to what extent, America's sort of cultural hegemony, American movies as we know them, are the result of sort of the concentration of the industry in a couple of cities and the culture that grew up around that. And I am both very sorry for all of these people, but I'm just curious what becomes of American movies.
I think the underlying this is why I mentioned the studio system, right? Because I do think that there's something to be said for the idea of the studio system as the shaper of the American dream, the American ideal. There was something about having the moguls in the 1920s, 30s, 40s who were like, we are the American dream makers. We are the American myth makers. This is what the people want to see. This is what the people in America and around the world want to see and think about America. And I do think that there is, you still get little hints of this with like Neon and A24. Neon is out in LA. A24 is out in New York. Pretty sure Neon's in LA. But those are more auteur driven. But they still have kind of an idea of what American films should look like. Though again, they have a lot of international dealings as well. I actually totally agree with you, Alyssa. I think it's bad for the idea of an American film industry for this to happen. I think it is good for the studios to be located in a centralized place and working in kind of a, we're getting a little far afield here. This is a very ironic thing for me to say. I like the idea of people working in offices and communing with each other and like sharing ideas. I work from home and I miss that. I think it's deleterious for my job, I wish I worked in the office. It's just not feasible for me, unfortunately. I think there's something to be said for that system where you have writers who are working together, you have studio heads who are like pulling in different directors and being like, ah, you're good for this, you're good for this. But that system itself has been kind of destroyed over the last, 50 or 60 years, right? The 70 years. The closest thing we have to it is probably, ironically, Kevin Feige and Marvel and James Gunn over at DC that are doing kind of that sort of thing. So I don't know.
And I know how excited you are about the next Marvel phase.
It's going to be great.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, whatever comes next may be great, may be innovative. There may be real benefits to doing away with gatekeepers, but I would just notice, there's going to be a cost to these people and there's going to be a cost to the art itself. And we probably won't know what that is until we're paying it.
Hot take, gatekeepers are actually good. All right. What do we think? Is production in Hollywood doomed? Alyssa?
Doesn't seem good.
Peter?
I mean, I think big, expensive productions anywhere are kind of doomed. Not in the next 5 years, but long term.
Yeah.
Los Angeles.
We're all doomed. That's the actual answer. We are all doomed. No bonus episode this week for reasons discussed at the top of the show. Remember, movieisle.substack.com. That's where this show will live from now on. And now on to the main event, The Smashing Machine. It's one of the few ones where the main event actually works for the movie we're talking about. The Smashing Machine. Dwayne The Rock Johnson stars as Mark Kerr, an MMA fighter making a name for himself in the world of pride fighting in Japan. This is before the UFC hit it big. The UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championship, existed, but it was still kind of small time. Pride was where the money was. Like, the Japanese were very into this kind of, I don't know really how to describe it as anything other than human cockfighting. Because that's what it was. It was, you had
John McCain called it.
Yeah.
He was like trying to get it banned in the late 90s.
You had a bunch of guys who were a bunch of different weight classes and a bunch of different fighting styles mixing it up and trying to kill each other. In the opening sequence of this film, Kerr kind of speaks with this almost like childlike softness and wonder, discussing his own surprise at what he finds in himself in the sport, about the willingness to keep going and about the ability to gouge a man's eyes out to win a fight. Kerr's a big guy. And Johnson is in some ways unrecognizable thanks to facial prosthetics. But when he turns just right and the light hits him just so, he's unmistakable as Dwayne Johnson, because like there's only a handful of human beings who have ever looked like Dwayne Johnson in this form. But he's got a big monkey on his back in the form of an opioid addiction. And when we see him, we see him injecting something early on, and I thought it was steroids, because that's kind of what you expect when you see a man like that injecting something into his arm. No, it turns out it was drugs, painkillers. You can understand different type of drugs, but you know, honestly, probably worse drugs, but, anyway, you can understand why he'd need to be numbed when we see what these guys go through. The brutality of mixed martial arts underlines pretty much everything we see in this movie. Kerr himself, however, not a brutal guy. We never feel as though he's going to like take a swing at his girlfriend, Dawn Staples, who's played by Emily Blunt. More on her in a minute. He'll certainly whine to her. He'll whine and whine to her about how she doesn't understand him and what he's going through, or the meaning of his ability to get in the ring in front of 50,000 people and how it's just like sex or whatever. But this is not Raging Bull. You're never afraid of Mark Kerr. You're never really afraid of what he's going to do to anyone in his life. And that is one of the reasons maybe that the movie feels so inert all the time. Look, there are some great sequences in this movie. There's a standout set piece about three quarters of the way in to Bruce Springsteen, set entirely to Bruce Springsteen's Jungle Land, first as like kind of a part of the film. It's diegetic sound, then it's non-diegetic sound, when it like kind of takes over the soundtrack and the score sends them out to the rest of the movie. And it has some great performances. Johnson has clearly gotten tired of being dismissed as a lightweight. Good for him. The best work in this movie, though, may actually come from professional MMA fighter Ryan Bader, who plays Mark Coleman as Kerr's kind of put-upon corner man. There is a version of this movie that is actually about Coleman, who has a much more traditional sports movie arc for a movie like this. We can maybe get into spoilers for a minute. I don't want to spoil anything just yet, but I remember watching the thing coming out and being like, now, why wasn't this movie about him? I saw this and when I wrote my review, I felt silly writing what I wrote, but I felt like the movie almost needed to be more formulaic. And it's weird because the smashing machine is in some ways very generic, right? You've got early success, and then you've got a drug problem in rehab, and then you've got love life difficulties, and then there's an eventual return to glory. But writer-director Benny Safdie very explicitly eschews playing off of that generic setup for a generic finale, because the real-life story doesn't pay off that way. It doesn't pay off that generic setup. And I don't think I've ever seen a movie, a fight movie, a boxing movie, wrestling movie, whatever. I don't think I've ever seen one that culminates precisely this way. Again, we can maybe talk spoilers in a minute. And as a result, I don't know. I sat there thinking to myself, this movie works as an intellectual exercise. It is emotionally satisfying. Not at all. It's a movie that asks what a sports biopic would look like from the a cautionary tale supporting character's point of view, rather than the hero who triumphs at the end against all odds. And as such, again, it just felt very inert. It didn't quite work for me as a whole. I liked it moment for moment, and then I would get a little bored moment to moment, and then I'd be like, oh yeah, this is a really great sequence, and then at the end of the movie, I was just like, oh, that's it? Yeah, okay, well, yeah, it's kind of like life, I guess. That's all we're getting here? Sure. Again, this is like life. Anyway, I don't think that's how you want to come out of a movie. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I am just too enamored of the Hollywood dream machine. Alyssa, before you discuss the movie more generally, I'm very curious to hear what you make of the Dawn Staples character, who was played by Emily Blunt, in what has to be one of the most thankless female roles I think I've ever seen in a movie. I remember just, I was watching it, I was like, I'm actually surprised they made this movie with this role written this way.
Yeah, she's the worst. And like, the idea that she and Mark break up and then like get back together and get married and have a kid, which I guess happened in real life, is just, she's unendurable, right? She's so incredibly irritating. And it's too bad, because there's actually a lot of productive tension that a different script could have mined from her plot line. Like, I think it is really interesting when you have two people in a relationship, one of whom really does need to get sober and one of whom does not and doesn't want to. And what does that do to that relationship when one of those people gets sober, is very sort of dedicated to that sobriety? You know, she had, the character has no redeeming characteristics, right? Like, she looks hot in like some weird animal print pantsuits, I guess.
She tried to make him that smoothie.
She did try to make him that smoothie.
He appreciated the half banana smoothie she made him. She didn't realize, how could she have known he'd updated to a banana and a half?
Yeah. And whole milk.
And whole milk. Yeah.
I mean, the woman neglects his saguaro cactus, right? Like,
that's the best scene in the movie.
Yes, there's a scene in the movie where
Dwayne Johnson, why didn't you cut my cactus the right way? I don't like the way the cactus is growing. Wouldn't it be like in the Looney Tunes,
like in the Roadrunner cartoon. Well, and as a gardener who's not nearly as sort of that precise about my gardening, I found that scene incredibly funny. But no, her character is just wholly unredeemable, and I think it is sort of in keeping with the movie's kind of like inability to build dramatic tension from scene to scene and sustain it. Like, the movie is very, very interested in sort of Care as a personality. And I think Johnson does really wonderful work. And in fact, like, a lot of his best performances come in roles where there is some kind of disconnect between his physicality and his demeanor. I don't know if either of you have ever seen Be Cool, the really terrible sequel to Get Shorty. But he is sort of the only interesting thing in the movie and this was very early in his career. He's playing a sort of closeted gay driver who was just like constantly berated by his employer. And the sort of disconnect between, you know, his bigness and the extent to which he was just like taking verbal abuse in the movie, and the sort of stoicism with which he took that was dramatically interesting, right? This performance actually in The Smashing Machine reminded me a lot of his performance in Southland Tales, where he plays basically like an amnesiac who was married to this, you know, important figure's daughter, but is shacked up with a porn star played by political commentator played by Sarah Michelle Gellar. And again, played someone who was just like really afraid a lot of the time. It's like, it's confused about where he is, where he's supposed to be. And his character in Pain and Gain has much the same quality, right? Like, he's an ex-con who, you know, kind of found Christianity, but just has this talent for, as he puts it, knocking people the fuck out. And that sort of tension between his ability and his desire to be a good person is, you know, one of the strong sort of animating through lines in that movie. And so here, you know, he plays this person who is like unfailingly courteous. And there's a very interesting coda to the movie where you see the real Mark Kerr shopping for groceries, and you see just like how similar Johnson's performance is to the real guy. You know, he's the kind of person who like really wants to know how the supermarket checker's day is going. And the movie takes brief sort of, you know, puffin-like flight off its glacier when you see the sort of tension between that desire to be polite and the points at which it doesn't get care the moment that like what he needs in any given moment, right? So there's a scene after Don has shown up at one of these pride matches in Japan, thrown him off his game, he's lost, and he's trying to get stronger painkillers out of whoever runs like the meds dispensary. And there's this very funny, weird clip where all he can get is Advil, and he turns to Don and he's like, "Do you want one?" They're handing them out like candy, right? And it's like, it is this moment of sort of terrible control in the character. There is a scene where, you know, he and Don have a fight after the match. And it's the one moment, you know, Sonny, you said that you never feel in the movie like Care would hurt his girlfriend. And there is this one scene where he just demolishes a door and like a flimsy like baseboard door in their house in Arizona. But you see, like, that's the one moment when he cannot maintain that control, right?
Though, one note on that scene, the door demolishing, is paired with his exquisitely careful carrying of a plate. That, like, the scene is set up to look like he's going to throw the plate, like you've seen in 1,000 yeah. movies when the couple has a fight. And instead, he carries this plate so delicately and sets it on the counter and then trashes the door and then trashes the door some more and then picks up the plate and carefully carries it over to the sink. And it is this interesting kind of moment of, you understand that on the one hand, he is very dangerous, but the movie is at least trying to signal to us, and I'm not sure how effective it is, that he is totally in control and but maybe not, right? It's like this weird, like the movie doesn't quite know how to like what to do with that, except that it is telling us, oh, he's always in control, but also he's very violent and could destroy something at any moment.
Right. And again, there's something interesting you could do there about, like, is fighting like a release of tension? Is it something that allows him to stay in control in the rest of his life? Does that dynamic feed on itself, where fighting allows him to release this tension that he then, you know, can be in control in his life and put that back into training towards fighting again? But again, like, the movie is not, it's just very interested in, like, care as a physical presence, in sort of care as a set of, like, mannerisms, and the number of shots that are just like, here are some of Dwayne Johnson's muscles. Like, there are quite a few of them. And I'm not saying that's bad necessarily, but the movie just, there's an incuriosity about it that is in some ways formally interesting, right? Like, we never, you know, we know he was, or, you know, he wrestled at Syracuse. Like, he's, you know, he's not a meathead. Like, he went to college. I mean, he's interested in gardening. You know, I mean, there's something, but you don't know why he's chosen this profession. You don't know how he ended up addicted to drugs. You don't know how he and Dawn got together. There's no sort of curiosity about the, like, you know, sobriety, someone who doesn't need to get sober dynamic. There's just, like, it's an incurious movie. In a way I found kind of odd, given some of the Safdie's other work. And then I think
there's
makes
a
it,
great distance and a great remove there. And the movie, I mean, it actually overlooks some points at which it could have investigated who he is and why he is doing this specific thing. Yeah. That kind of funny scene in which the Japanese rulemakers announce all of the prohibited moves, like, you cannot strike somebody in the face when they're in this position. You cannot kick them in the head, right? Like, this whole litany of things that we learn are now prohibited. You get I think it's the Russian guy who, like, his handler, the woman, stands up and, like, asks very specifically about when you can kick someone in the face. It's kind of funny. Yeah. But my understanding is that the real life version of that, those rules were made specifically because to make sure that Mark Kerr could not win as quickly and as easily, because he had become such a machine in the ring that he was making the matches too short. And they wanted the matches to be longer and more satisfying for television. So they took away basically all of his signature moves. Yeah. And that's an interesting thing that, like, this sport is like, this sport is trying to prohibit him from using his innovative tactics. But we don't get that in the movie.
No. This movie, it's such a weird movie because it does feel totally, it's totally uninterested in mixed martial arts as either a business or a sport, in a way that I don't think I've ever seen in a movie of this sort. There's really very little. There's just no discussion of tactics. There's no discussion of, like, the actual kind of interesting breakdown of why he is fighting in Japan instead of America. Like,
you get that one line about, oh, they're trying to ban it here, from the old lady.
Right.
Yeah. But there's no dynamic to any of the matches. Like, you never understand what makes someone superior to someone else in a given match, right? Like, there are periodic things where it's like someone calls a foul. Like, it's like, oh, that guy's like a good boxer, right? But there's no, you know, and maybe this is in keeping with sort of the reason for the rule changes that you were talking about, Peter, but there's no arc to any of the matches. Like, they're relatively short. There isn't sort of narrative to them the way that you saw in Ryan Coogler's Creed movies. There's just not, like, there's no plot. And given that the whole thing is supposed to be to determine which martial art is most effective, I felt like I didn't come away understanding any of that at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think this movie was made for people who already understand that Mark Kerr was an early innovator in basically what became the meta, but what became the sort of main tactic in mixed martial arts, UFC style fighting, which was initially this was a sport that was designed to test different fighting styles against each other. And eventually it became a sport that is just about guys who try to take other people down and then beat the crap out of them once they have them in a hold on the ground. And Mark Kerr was was an early innovator in that sort of, we're going to do wrestling and take people down, put them in a hold, and then we're going to do strikes against them when we have them in the hold position. And that now seems to be like the main way that these fights play out is wrestling maneuvers to get people down, then strikes. And Mark Kerr was somebody who was important
ground and pound
in making that habit. Right. Ground it. He was the ground and pound guy. And in fact, like I said, those moves were taken, like the movie kind of presents those moves as being taken off as being prohibited in a way that's like, oh, that's going to be bad for the Russian who then cheats. When in fact, it was about disarming Kerr, which is just not something you learn from the movie at all. So, Sonny, you said that this movie was not emotionally satisfying, and I would put it differently. This movie is not thematically satisfying. Because I can kind of see what I think Benny Safdie is trying to do here. But I don't think that this movie really delivers a clear enough sense to the viewer about what it is trying to do. And I think that what it is ultimately trying to do is actually not be a movie about ultimate fighting, about mixed martial arts. It is a movie about how the brutality in the ring cannot be contained to the ring. Even in a guy like Mark Kerr, who you see as somebody who's like, he's so gentle. He's so nice. He's so sweet. You know, the way he interacts with that old woman in the doctor's office, even that moment where he's tearing down the door, like we talked about, the moment of greatest violence in his home, you see that he is trying to contain his inherent violence by holding that plate and by not breaking it. You see there's a somewhere in the first 20 minutes or so of the film, there's an interview. Is it with Mark Kerr or is it with Mark Coleman, where one of them talks about this sort of having to kind of have total emotional control when you're in the ring. I'm pretty sure this is a Kerr interview, right?
Yeah.
Right. And that is in some ways the sort of thematic statement of this movie is, yeah, you think you can do that, but you can't. You can't do it. But the movie, like, I'm struggling to pull this out of the movie because it is not there. Like, it's, or I won't say it's not there, but it doesn't connect and come together nearly enough. And I don't think this movie needs to be more formulaic. I think it needs to needs to be clearer about what it is that it's trying to say about this person and his life and why it matters. And the movie doesn't do that. It doesn't, like, I complain on this podcast regularly about movies that just have a big speech where you state the theme and explain what it's about. But this movie doesn't, it's not just that it doesn't have that. It's that it often seems like it doesn't really know how to communicate what it is about. It is uncertain about its own purpose and its own view of its main character. And I am pulling this thing out of it because I think this is what Safdie is going for. And I think the problem is that Safdie is somebody who really loves extremely naturalistic performances and a kind of naturalistic chaos and lack of cohesion to his scenes. Go back to the movies he made with his brother, right? And they are so chaotic. They are so driven by improvisational, dialogue and shooting and scene making and a lot of amateur actors, right? And he just wants to capture that and then kind of string it together somehow or another without telling you what it's about. That can work, but in this movie, it just doesn't quite come together enough. And so everything seems sort of segmented and fragmented. And like, it's like, here is a scene that's a very good scene. Shouldn't there then be some flow? Nope, we're just going to get another scene. It's a pretty good scene. But yeah. What does it have to do with the one that came before or after it? Well, it has to do. It's got Mark Kerr in all of these scenes.
It's his life.
And like, fair enough. That's sometimes how life works. But that's not how movies work.
It's just unsatisfying. And I it's so interesting to compare this to Safdie's earlier stuff, like Uncut Gems, obviously, but also Good Time or his Showtime show with Emma Stone and Nathan Fielder, The Curse, which those are movies that are very tense. They're not always frenetic, but they're very tense kind of throughout. And this is just a movie that is totally lacking in tension almost throughout, which is why I like, and it's, you would think, okay, it's a sports movie. You have contests. You have winners and losers. There should be real tension of like, okay, who's going to win? Who's going to lose? And even in the fights themselves, I often found myself thinking like, okay, all right. I don't know, man. It's such a strange movie. And I say all this and I feel like I've been complaining the whole episode, but I didn't hate it. I didn't hate it.
It's incredibly technically proficient. I mean, they literally rebuilt Mark Kerr's house, four rooms from Mark Kerr's house for the sets, right? The way it's shot, that sort of partly grainy, washed out look to it is just great. And then the sense of naturalism from all the performances, but particularly Ryan Bader as Mark, I think it's Ryan Bader, right? As Mark Coleman.
As Coleman.
And then Dwayne Johnson as Mark Kerr. Just two incredible standout performances. And that's what holds the movie together is Dwayne Johnson's performance. Dwayne Johnson's performance is really excellent. I don't know if it's the best performance of the year, but it's certainly going to be on any short list. It's remarkable, and it is just a reminder that this guy's been doing these kind of trashy, incredibly formulaic, successful, like definitely successful action movies for the last 15 years. And he's a really good actor. He's a really good actor, and we don't need him in Red Notice or Red Note. I'm sorry. He needs him like for $40 million or whatever they're paying him. Great. Take the money. I wish he was doing a one for them and one for me this whole time, because anytime he shows up with an interesting director and a part that lets him show what he can do, he just rules. He makes this movie worth existing, even though the thing itself is kind of ill-conceived.
Can I also just take a moment to call out the work of the makeup and prosthetics department in this movie? Because I think that it is easy to get caught up in sort of very like high level prosthetics work on sci-fi and fantasy films. But this is a movie that I think really does not work without the prosthetics and makeup the way it does, because it gets Johnson sort of far enough away from himself that he can get away from his own persona and act. And the thoughtfulness of the prosthetics in this movie, like it's not just sort of his nose, but like these folks designed like distinct cauliflower ears for all the guys who wrestle in this movie, right? Like there is just like a level of thought and care about all of this. And Kazuhiro, who I think was the lead prosthetic makeup designer, also did like the work for Leonard Bernstein in Maestro. He did a lot of the work in Bombshell and Mindhunter, and did like the hair design for Gary Oldman when he played Winston Churchill in Darkest Hour. And, you know, again, we just don't talk very much about makeup and prosthetics on the show, but I think this is the kind of movie where if you're interested in how that kind of detail work can be incredibly transformative and important to the movie, The Smashing Machine is a really good example of how much that kind of craft work matters.
And it's at least mostly and maybe all analog.
Yeah. No, it's funny. Again, like I said in my kind of prologue, you definitely are like, oh, this does not look like Dwayne Johnson. And then every once in a while, he turns his head just so, and you're like, oh yeah, that's totally him. And it's mostly at the end when they shave his head, and that gets him closest to like his traditional The Rock character sort of look, like how he has looked in wrestling for the last 10 or 15 years or so with that totally shaved head. Like it's when that happens that you're like, oh yeah, yeah, no, I see it now. I get that's our guy.
But it's only like the one scene right after he shaves his head where he turns. You're right. It is a turn. You see him from the rear where his prosthetics are less visible, less prominent, right? Because the prosthetics are mostly about shaping the silhouette of his face. And you see that turn, and you can see the body of The Rock with the shaved head. And then he turns in, and okay, yes, you can still see the prosthetics, but it's like suddenly you see the eyes and the bald pate and the whole thing. And you're like, oh yeah, that is him. Yeah, and then even after that, for the rest of that third act, he's just Mark Kerr.
Yeah.
He's just somebody else. And it's a phenomenal performance in a just okay movie.
That sounds about right. It is, again, I will say, I do actually prefer Bader's performance as Coleman a little more. And that is kind of the more traditional Safdie-esque.
Yeah.
We got a normal guy here, and we're going to do some fun stuff with him. And there is a version of this movie that is about him, that is about Coleman, who, like, I get spoilers now that you're 50 minutes into it. Spoilers here, but like the end of the movie, Kerr doesn't even fight in the final fight. He loses in the semifinals. He's not in the championship bout. It's not even like he's in the championship bout and he loses to his friend, which is another version, is like another Hollywood version of this, right? Like kind of the Rocky one sort of thing, except Creed and Rocky weren't friends, but like it's
not just another version of this movie.
Yeah.
It is the movie that this film sets you up for. And it's an interesting choice to sit, like, this is the way the movie tries to build tension. You talked about the lack of it. The movie tries to build tension for an event that never happens.
Right.
I get what they were doing, but it's weird.
It's weird and unsatisfying. It does not work as drama.
Look, I can see how that could work as drama. I can see how it is a subversion of the trope, but it just straightforwardly, in a very conventional way, does all the setup work. And then, that's not happening. He's going to be getting stitches while Mark Coleman is out there winning the tournament. I guess that's life. I mean, it is.
That's life. That is just life. That's life. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Smashing Machine, Alyssa?
Thumbs sort of 55% up, and like almost all of that is Dwayne Johnson.
Peter.
Yeah, basically the same. I mean, I actually think the technical work on this film is also really excellent, not just the prosthetics, but all the sets work, the production design, the camera work, etc. Like, this is a technically excellent film with a great performance at the center that also has been edited and scripted in a pretty weird way. Yeah. So thumbs up, but it has some issues.
Thumbs up, mostly because of the use of Jungle Land, which is just it's a really great sequence. I gotta say, I had been like kind of iffy on the movie up until then, and I saw that and I was like, yes, this is great. Let's go into the final act. I'm pumped. I'm ready for the final act. And then the final act happens. I'm like, oh yeah, that's it. That's all we got here. But still, if the Bruce Springsteen movie with the guy from The Bear is half as good as this sequence, it'll be a pretty good movie. All right, that's it for today's episode. Many thanks to our producer, Dante DiCicco. Tell your friends, a strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we die. If you did not love this episode, please complain to me at Twitter, @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week at movieisle.substack.com.